Welcome to The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, on this first week of December edition of our show with the team around the table. Ted number one, Mott, Steve, Candace, and Ted Theodore number two.
Down over here. Right, two Theodores.
Yeah, and two of us have beverages. I have my ginger snap latte, and he has the little bottle that he's chugging down there, so that's good. On this week's show, we're going to be talking in a few minutes to Ryan Dobson, who is the son of our founder, Dr. James Dobson, and he has written a book called Wrecked. We're going to be talking about that today, a very appropriate topic. How do you be real with the people in your Christian community, and why don't Christians do more of that? Also, Suzanne Hadley is here for The Hungry Years this week. And then our inbox question is going to be a follow-up to Mott's blog post, his recent blog post on those pseudo-spouses in the workplace. So one of our readers has put forth kind of a scenario and wants some help with it, so we're going to weigh in on that. But for the roundtable today, we're actually going to be talking about the second installment in the Guy's Guide to Marrying Well series, tackling the topic of purity today. For those of you who know and are following us faithfully, as many of you are, our last one we talked about intentionality. So now we're back with purity. Don't forget to download the ebook, The Guy's Guide to Marrying Well, off of boundless.org if you haven't done so already. Again, it is free. We love things that maybe you should just download a bunch of copies. You have to sign up and then just put it in people's stockings. That's what I think. All those guys out there.
Actually, I think you can just download it once and then on the print screen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, put in 100.
Oh, whatever. Right. Okay.
Yeah, and then just in your dorm room or your apartment building or, you know, just under the doors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Distribute. Mass distribution.
And we may be printing them next year.
Oh,
but
good.
In the meantime, It goes great with Christmas cards.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Merry Christmas and get married.
Put it in. Yeah. Put it in the guys' mailboxes along with the Victoria's Secret catalogs that they should not be receiving. Okay. I'm very upset about the number of guys that receive the Victoria's Secret catalog.
You know, that bothers me too.
Seriously, they get it like sent to their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Thank
that
you.
That is a whole other issue.
Never
heard of that.
Gentlemen around the table for having puzzled looks. We are very glad.
We do appreciate that.
Yeah.
But for those of you out there who don't have puzzled looks, I rebuke you and stop it. Okay, so let's talk about with that.
On that happy note.
On that happy note and on that positive reinforcement, let's jump into today's topic. And let me just throw out there, why do you think that this even has to be a highlighted section of this ebook? Why do we have to talk about purity in guys?
Because guys are getting Victoria's Secret catalogs in the mail.
Well,
true. The premise, obviously, of A Guy's Guide to Marrying Well is to achieve their goal, which most guys and the majority of guys coming out of high school say that marrying well is a important life accomplishment. If that is the goal, purity is absolutely essential to marrying well. I mean, that's the first and foremost way of looking at it. Even before you get into what God says about sexual purity and how he designed us and what his plans are and designs are for how we live out our lives as sexual people.
So that's necessary, and you're saying that every guy naturally wants to marry well, and certainly Christian men do. And I would say that they also have this vague notion of, yeah, I want to be pure, I want to, you know, adhere to the standards of Scripture. But let's talk a little bit about what that actually means, because we need to go beyond just purity rings.
Well, and do they say, do most guys say, yeah, I want to adhere to what Scripture says, or do they go with what is just...
No,
the status quo in the culture
actually,
around them.
Even in secular research, there's this context that even non-believers want to hang out with the dancer girl who's kind of wild and loose, but they don't want to marry her.
Yeah.
They want to marry the person who's going to be a loyal, dependable wife and a good mother and is going to be a great lifelong companion. And so most of it is this struggle they have that they do. Most guys, believe it or not, have this innate desire to marry well someday.
Well, they do, but it doesn't mean that they
but
won't
along
have sex
the
with
way,
before,
that's right.
before marriage.
Well, and do they realize how hanging out with the floozy might limit their opportunities to marry well down the road?
It's a struggle with the here and the down the road. It's right in front of me right now. I have sexual desires. Down the road, I have this long-term goal of wanting to marry well. And so I think what we're getting at in terms of purity is to reach that long-term goal that most men have, you have to deal with the here and now and the decisions you're making along the way.
Well, we live in a culture that has little, if any, support for a pure lifestyle And no expectation for it on the part of singles. There was an article yesterday in a paper about a couple that waited to their wedding altar to kiss, which I know Ted has talked about on Boundless, that he and Ashley were able to do that successfully. I know that's an extreme example. Most people won't go to that length to, you know, save everything for their wedding night. But this couple did, and it was shocking how dismissive and really critical the comments were, saying, okay, you know, I'm going to get away from this freak show and back to the real world. And I mean, it's like there's absolutely no, not even is there no support for purity. There's no tolerance for it in our culture.
But getting back to your question, Ken, is for most Christian guys, yeah, I think most of them want to remain pure before the wedding date. The question is, what is pure? What is purity? Mm. And I think that's where you have a lot of qualification in the minds of guys. And I think that's where this guy's guide adds a lot of clarity.
So then what is purity?
Well, we read in the Bible that we're to treat each other with absolute purity. And, you know, one way of thinking about purity is, you know, this nice, clean bucket of water. And we could have questions about what is pure. You know, how much of a contaminant do you tolerate before it's not pure? But the term absolute purity is a strong term of absolutely no impurity. And so you think about, though, our culture, which is has the mindset of how much can we get away with? What is the line? And really, that's almost a way of saying, I'm not going to act with absolute purity. I'm going to act with as much impurity as I can get away with. And if you think about it, too, this is a culture that learned to be more responsible about sexuality. They learned from, you know, the hedonistic out-of-control 70s that we should be responsible. They learned all the diseases you could get. They learned all the consequences. But in a lot of ways, what they learned was consequence management, which meant, okay, I know that there's a possibility of unplanned pregnancy. I know there's a possibility of a sexual disease. Then what I'm going to do is, instead of living in absolute purity, is I'm going to try to enjoy the benefits of premarital sexuality and control the potential consequences. And that's not absolute purity. And so I think this guy's guide is trying to get back to a context of purity that goes way beyond consequence management and moves it back towards God's design that actually does result in a good marriage.
Let me jump in there, Steve. There's an article in this guy's guide on the boiling pot. Yeah. And I encourage readers to go in there and read that. But I read all the emails that are sent to editor at boundless.org, and pretty much without exception, any individual that's experiencing difficulty in their relationship with their boyfriend or girlfriend, pretty much without exception, they always say, well, we've had sex, mm-hmm. or we haven't had sex, but we've been sexually active.
That's right.
And the truth is that clouds our ability to discern God's will for the relationship.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, well, whenever you see a couple that can't break up that everybody knows, man, why are they still together? Sure. It's inevitably they're sleeping together.
And I'll give you a tragic example. We had an interview with Michael Lawrence from Capitol Hill Baptist Church, and he made the comment. He said, as a pastor doing premarital counseling, I've never had a couple say, I sure wish we had had more sex before we got married. And I think of a relative of mine, I'm not going to name him, but who should have had his 20-year wedding anniversary this past spring, but instead went through a painful divorce. And just talking to him about what had taken place in that relationship, so much of it came back to his premarital sex with his wife, as well as premarital sex that they had with other people, and what that did to the relationship. I mean, the things it brought into the relationship, the vulnerability it created to future affairs, people just don't take that into account anymore, just what that does to the relationship down the road.
Well, isn't it interesting, too, how erotic Song of Solomon is? And it's all pre-wedding. It's all, the whole book requires the anticipation of sex within marriage. You know, there would be no Song of Solomon if Solomon and his fiance mm-hmm. were shacking up. You know, I mean, you would have none of that anticipation, none of that excitement about, we are excited about being together sexually. We love each other. We're committed. And we're looking forward to this future time. And when you have premarital sex, that anticipation and the looking forward is taken away.
Yeah, Song of Solomon celebrates sex in the appropriate context, but nobody's celebrating premarital sex. It's
Well, and the specific line is, do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. And that is the entire context of purity before marriage.
Well, and meaning not pleases in the sense we know it as, hey, I'm ready, it pleases me now, mm-hmm. but in the sense of until it's appropriate, until it's right and righteous.
Okay, so getting down to brass tacks here, I think a lot of people are discouraged right now because we have got a lot of dysfunction in our culture. And we're kind of talking, I feel like, on this plane where there's a lot of ideal circumstances. And a lot of, you know, what do you say to the guy that comes up to you and says, it's just too difficult. People are getting married older. I'm in these situations with women. You know, I'm not just running around in my church with these maidens who are whatever, modest and stuff like that. It's just not feasible. And it just reminds me, I'm going to go through like 6 weeks in a row here talking about John Piper, but I don't even care. I'm just going to mention him again. John, please endorse this show because quite frankly, I give you too many shout outs on it. he talked about, it was at New Attitude in his talk, and he talked about this guy that had approached him and said, yeah, he said, well, you know, I cannot face the possibility of like dying and not having had sex, you know, and I just don't know. It's just not doable for me. I can't think of that possibility. And John Piper basically said, well, you know, you don't know, basically knowing God's story, and you don't know how that's going to play out. And if ultimately your story does not involve sex, do you trust God enough to know that his story for you is better mm-hmm. than one that you think has to be crafted for yourself? And he said, and quite frankly, you know, our best moral example of all time, Jesus Christ, never had sex. So, you know, go talk to him about it. And so I thought that was just very, because I think, don't you think that this whole issue comes down to an issue of trust ultimately? I mean, it's someone who is anticipating marriage and it's not happening. It's someone who's anticipating sex and it's not happening. And do you trust God more than your circumstances, your desires, your... Okay, that was like three questions, but well, what about
no,
that?
No, that's, Lisa, that's a really raw... honest question. I had that thought when I was single. I refused to die a virgin. Mm-hmm. I mean, thank God he, you know, sent a husband. But mm-hmm. I never acted on that threat. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of singles, a lot of our listeners have probably at points in their life had that thought. Like, this isn't fair. And especially, like you said, people marrying later. And so they're waiting an extra decade in most cases. And to live in a culture where not only is everybody doing it, but they're doing it, you know, in such a public way. It's like you can't even get away from it.
Well, I think
I'm not justifying the guy's question, but I'm saying... I think a lot of us have had that thought.
Mm-hmm. And for guys, I think it's important to tie sexual desire to marriage. I mean, it is to tell them, and it's what Al Mohler says, it is to tell them that they are made for marriage mm-hmm. and that they should be pursuing marriage now, especially if you're out of college, a young man out of college has a job, pursue marriage. That's what your sexual desire is telling them. But until that happens, I think it's a lie from our culture that we are a slave to our sexual desire. We are not. If you are a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, you are not a slave anymore. If you believe the power of the gospel, you can be pure. That doesn't mean you won't fall, but that's something you should strive for until you are married.
Yeah, I think we've had in our desire to be compassionate to people who are marrying later, who don't have the same sexual outlets that marriage provides, I think there is almost this desire to dumb things down and to tolerate more sexual activity among Christians. And we shouldn't be surprised that studies by the Center for Disease Control show that 77% of guys who are raised in Protestant fundamentalist homes have sex before marriage. And that those who didn't have sex before marriage had solo sex viewing internet pornography. I mean, that's the reality of where most of our listeners are. And so we're not trying to be hyper-idealistic here. We're trying to say this is the world we live in. This is a world that's sexually broken. This is a world that idolizes sexuality, that sex permeates everything. But it's everything and nothing. It's lost all meaning. It's lost all context. We're overdue for rediscovering what God designed that sexuality to be for. And it is about marriage. Our culture has separated sexuality from marriage. It's separated sexuality from children. And it's also separated sex from God's idea of teaching us what it means to be one and what he was trying to tell us about Christ's relationship with the church. I mean, look at the passage in Ephesians 5, and he says, you know, this is a great mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. We are made in his image, And we've totally lost any context about how he wants to relate to us by the way we relate in marriage and all the things that sex has to do with that, because our culture's turned it all upside down.
Well, and I would hope that John Piper, when he got that question from that guy, didn't just say, do you trust God's plan, but maybe threw in something like, so what are you doing to pursue marriage? If you want sex so bad, if you are burning, let's read what Paul says to the young men who are burning. Get married.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that Pastor Piper would have a word like that.
Because there is protection in marriage.
Absolutely. And that's the message Dr. Moeller has, that if you, you know, if you're past a certain age, you should be looking around saying, okay, Lord, where have you placed me? Who are the young women in this life that you've given me? And who should I be considering as a potential spouse?
Well, and I think what Steve said is very appropriate, too, and that is that our understanding is so finite. I mean, we don't know, looking ahead 20 years, like you're saying, what ramifications there are to choices that we've made prior. And we think that we can look at it and say we can get over it, or we can, you know, certainly you can circumvent a lot of this, but in many cases, that's not true. And at the same time, people that have waited until marriage for any kind, you know, obviously sex itself, but, you know, other forms of intimacy as well, I've never heard a negative story from anyone who said that they wish they would have done it differently, kind of like what Ma was saying.
Lisa, one of the first jobs I had here at Focus on the Family was working in our public policy department and worked on internet issues. And you can't deal with internet issues without confronting the major issue of the proliferation of pornography. And so we were motivated to create a website called pureintimacy.com. And part of that site was paid for by revenue from these videos that they created of an interview Dr. Dobson did with the serial killer Ted Bundy. And this next January is going to be the 20th anniversary of that interview. And at the time, Ted Bundy was saying, boy, I just can't believe the amount of sexual, degrading sexual material that's out available to people. And this was 20 years ago. This was before the internet. And he was talking about, you know, his concern of what culture was going to look like in the future. Now, the reality is all this proliferation of pornography has not created a million Ted Bundys. But I tell you what it has done is it's created lifeless marriages. It's created directionless singles, people who have lost any sense of healthy direction and motivation in relationships. And it is a tragedy. It truly is a victorious day for our spiritual enemy, who has taken one of the best things God's given us and totally twisted it and distorted it, and in the name of immediate pleasure has created long-term misery.
Yeah, it has distorted what is true and beautiful in marriage, and because the pornographic images stay with you. Yeah. They don't disappear. And that's something that you carry with you. The more you engage in that sin, the more it stays with you, the more desensitized you become. And that's how you can have a passionless marriage, and that's how it distorts it within marriage, just to get practical on it.
And to that end, we should speak now to the guy who's out there who is saying, boy, this is really convicting. I want to change. This is a gripping struggle. To say sites like pureintimacy.com are very helpful, because one of the key points they offer is that God made us body, mind, and spirit. And there are a lot of services out there now that are trying to help people overcome this struggle. And some of them just deal with the body. I mean, there's one guy who says, you know, every time you have a tempting thought, pop a rubber band on your wrist, and that'll make you change your behavior. Well, just the body's not enough. And there are some that say you need to change how you think, change your mind, and then your behaviors will follow. And that's not enough, because God made us spiritual beings. And restoration really is a restoring of the body, the mind, and the spirit. And there really are some great things available through pure intimacy. I mean, just encourage people to go there and take advantage of those great materials to start experiencing recovery.
Well, that's good. And I think there is a sense of, you know, ending on a positive note, there is a sense of victory and a sense of, you know, I don't want to say accomplishment, but whatever, for those who have waited, you know, and who can now look back on that. I know one of my friends said that she and her husband, you know, had quite a struggle waiting until they got married. But she said, and then when it came to their wedding night, she was just like, we just knew we were going to do it. Even if the Lord raptured us, we were going to do it on the way up. And just come to that.
Come, Lord Jesus, in 5 minutes.
Exactly. She's like, you know, kind of like the we earned it kind of sense. So anyway, good for them. But, well, excellent. Thank you guys for all weighing in on this, especially you gentlemen, obviously. Given that, this is The Guy's Guide to Marrying Well. Again, download that at boundless.org. And tell your friends about it as well.
Oh, come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. Oh, come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of angels. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ the
today's culture segment. I have with me in the studio a guy with whom I go back a ways, quite a ways, probably like 8 years maybe now at this point.
Yeah, it's 8 years. Oh my goodness, that's a long time.
Yeah, we are aging rapidly. His name is Ryan Dobson. You may recognize the name not only from Dr. JCD, Dr. Dobson, but also many of Ryan's pursuits that are independent from Focus on the Family, certainly. Ryan is an author. He is the president and founder of Core Ministries. He actually came back now. He moved to Colorado, which is very exciting, which he probably just did for the snowboarding and whatnot. But
yeah, for the cold. That's so nice.
For the cold. He is the father of a little boy named Lincoln and the husband of Laura. So he is now, you know, he's now established his life in a sensible way.
You were the beginning of a little bit of a roller coaster for me.
A little bit of a roller coaster. I may call you out on a little bit of that
because
I remember some craziness. But Ryan is also the author of several books, the latest of which is Wrecked, a book that he wrote with Tobin Heim. And we're going to actually talk about the content of some of this book today, as well as just some, you know, we'll probably take off on a few different subjects related to that. But anyway, welcome, Ryan, to
Thank
the Boundless
you.
Show.
Good to be here. I can't believe it's been 8 years.
It's been 8 years.
You have not. We were on the National Bike Ride for the Family team together, and I have not ridden my bike since the last one that I was on.
Whoa. Yeah. Like at all?
Nope, not one time.
Oh, my.
I've ridden a mountain bike a couple times, BMX bike a couple times, but the road bike has been forever packed. When I figured out how many miles it would, when I knew how many miles it would take to become numb, I thought that was probably enough time to ride the bike. Yeah.
I like how you, you know, you talk about in the book here, how, you know, you have a lot of, I think every one of us maybe plans our life how we think it's going to look. Mm-hmm. And we think that we have our, on average, 80 years here. I was just listening to a John Piper study, or I just finished a John Piper study the other night, and he talks about how we're so, we've orchestrated our lives the way that we want them, but we don't know. We don't know if we have 80 years. We don't know if we have a week.
No, and so, definitely not.
And we certainly don't know what's going to happen within that amount of time. And so, you know, we need to expect suffering, we need to expect tragedy, we need to expect heartache, and then there's a lot of good that comes along with that as well. What would you say, Ryan, just kicking off here, what brought you to the point of writing about stuff like that?
Oh, Tobin brought me to that. He came to me and said, you should write this book. And I thought, I definitely don't want to write this book. You know, I don't like revisiting, you know, people are like, oh, you know, do you journal? I'm like, no, I don't want to go back and relive all those things. You know, people that have journals from 8-10 years ago, I don't want to go relive that stuff. And, you know, that book took, I've written 4 books, that took longer than the first 3 combined to actually write. And it was because it was so painful to go back and revisit a lot of those things. I think one of the things that dawned on me, a couple of years ago, we lost Laura's mom when she was pregnant with Lincoln. And, you know, it was one of those tragic situations I've ever been involved in, especially while she's pregnant with our, you know, son. Mm-hmm. And there was a time where we were with a bunch of friends like, hey, how you guys doing? I'm like, oh, yeah, we're fine, you know. And, I kept walking. I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I am so not fine. Why am I telling people I'm fine? And this is a friend of mine. It's not the checkout person at the supermarket. It's someone that cares about me. And I called Tobin and we really started diving into that because what you said earlier, we have the ability to pull back, especially in singleness. You know, you can change churches or change circles of friends and it takes you out of a community and out of relationships and it makes you isolated. And isolation is going to lead to more and more and more heartache. You've got to be able to be in people's grills and you know, what would have happened if Job's friends had just shut up, just sat there with him, said, I'm sorry. You know, that's all they need to say is, I'm sorry. Don't have encouraging words. Let people be sad. I mean, sadness can be one of the greatest experiences in your life of just wallowing in your misery and allowing that to flow over you. That's what the book really is about, is learning from suffering, leaning into suffering. Don't run from it, and how that can create the greatest relationships and community. Tobin was there when I was going through some of my darkest hours. And life is messy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a great package. You can just put a little bow on. It's going to be, you mm-hmm. know, turn out great. It gets sticky and messy. And having people that sit in the muck with you and allow you to be sad, allow you to be wounded and hurt are the ones that last a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. So talk about what that looked like a little bit for you specifically as you were going through some of these dark times. I mean, did you have a period where you were like, you know, should I let it show? Shouldn't I? Should I share? Shouldn't I? How did you find those safe people? And then what did you share and in what kind of increments?
Oh, yeah. I think it goes in circles of friends. You know, when the checkout person at the supermarket goes, hey, how you doing? It's probably not the time to pour your heart out. Mm-hmm. But you've got to have friends that you can. And if you're not able to be open and be messy with your friends, you probably want to choose new friends. Mm-hmm. And I've got some great friends, some people that you know real well. And with those people, they just let me, you know, vent and be frustrated and be sad and didn't have to fix it. That's one of the greatest things about friends. You don't have to fix everything. The hardest part of that is when you get married. Because when my wife is sad, I want to make it better. Mm-hmm. I want to say it's okay. We lost Laura's mom. And when she's sad about that, I want to go, oh, honey, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But it's not okay. And it's never going to be okay. Mm-hmm. It's never going to be okay to lose your mom. It's never going to be okay to lose your mom when you're pregnant, when you need your mom. And what I've got to say is, I'm sorry. I am sorry that you're sad. And be totally okay with her sadness. And it's difficult. As a husband, I want to fix and mend and make better and, you know, get happy. And it puts pressure on her to be someone that she's not able to be at that time, or to fake it. Mm-hmm. And if she's got to fake it and put on the happy face, that means she's isolating herself from me because I'm not able to be open with her, mm-hmm. instead of just being in the sadness together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what would you say? I mean, tell me if you think you see this as a trend. What do you do if you're a person in your 30s, say, and I've seen this especially or heard this from my guy friends, they wake up in their 30s and realize they have no real relationships.
Yeah.
What in the world do they do with that? And all of a sudden they're hitting up against something like a parent's
Definitely.
Dying or they're going through a breakup or a divorce in a marriage or whatever, and they're floundering. What do they do?
You know, it's such a great point. Esquire magazine recently had an article and it said, you know, guys used to have a big group of friends. They'd get together and work on cars or go fishing or play cards or something, but they had a large group of friends. And today most guys don't. And if you wake up in your 30s and you don't have a lot of friends, I'd start making them. You know, figure out what it is you like to do. My Bible study meets at a fly fishing shop. I'm a terrible fly fisher. I enjoy it, but I'm horrible. I've mastered what we call the long release. It means you get a fish on the line and then it gets off of it, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, actually holding it and deciding whether I want to release it or not. Mm-hmm. But we meet in a fly fishing shop. It's just guys. We hang out and sometimes we watch a video. Sometimes we, you know, read from a book. Sometimes we just hang out. I didn't get to go on it, but this past weekend they did a retreat together, and women weren't invited, not because we don't like women, but because it's time to be around guys and get two or three guys and then, you know, invite more into the group in like-minded pursuits. I don't care if you play video games. I've got a friend that they've got a couples Bible study, and now that they've got children, they don't do the couples together because someone's got to watch kids. And so one night the women go and the men watch kids, and the other night women watch kids, men go. The men go and play video games. That's their Bible study. Hmm. You know, on their own they read the Word and they do some different things. But it's a like-minded group of guys that play, you know, Gears of War and Halo and different things because they enjoy it together, and allows them in their down times to call one of those guys and say, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going through this problem. And that guy, I can think of a friend of mine now. I was venting about something that was going on in my life, and he's like, it's not just me, you have that too. And we bonded on that. We didn't fix the problem. It was not solved, but it felt better to know somebody else dealt with that. And I know when I'm going through another situation similar to that, I can call Marshall and say, dude, I can't believe it's happening again. And he go, me too, it just happened the other day. Mm-hmm. And it allows me to alleviate some of that pressure and to take some of it off. You've mm-hmm. got to get friends.
Mm-hmm. And don't you think that everyone out there, I mean, this is so common for us, we think that what we're going through is completely unique yeah. to us. And I mean, really, aren't there just, I mean, I think to myself sometimes, really, there's got to be just like, you know, 10 categories of life garbage out there, and everything falls into one of those categories, and everyone's dealing with at least several of them at one time.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's just like, you know, what have you found in your experience, Ryan, in just entering into that with people, you know, and finding commonalities in that? How do you do that? And especially as a guy, do it without, you know, because women, you know, we always say, well, we're just going to sit down with our little coffee cups and take out some little pink and green book that some woman wrote, you know, it's all fuzzy and whatever, and we'll emote and then watch a movie or something.
And then have a good cry.
Exactly. Have a good cry yeah. and then follow up and then maybe send a stuffed animal or something. But what does that look like for men?
You know, I'll be honest, it was baffling to me when I was dating Laura, my wife, and then we were married, and she would purposely watch a sad movie so she could cry. And I would look at her, and she's just bawling, and I'm like, oh, are you okay? She's like, oh, I just need to cry. I'm like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, and I'm thinking, do I leave? Do I, you know, what do I do? And she just wanted to cry. She's like, you don't need to be here. You don't need to be, you know, be involved in this. I'm just going to cry. I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think if you've got a good group of guy friends, you've got a couple of guys that you can trust, it will take vulnerability. And that's what authentic relationships and friendships are made of. It's vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And it takes at some point someone taking the first step and saying, hey, I'm having a tough time today, or I'm frustrated about this, or this made me angry, or I'm sad, and seeing where it goes. And sometimes guys don't handle it real well. They're like, you know, and you've got to let them process it in the way that they can and see if that can develop. And most of the time it will. You know, don't expect, you know, the big heartfelt, you know, I'm going to put my arms around you and we're going to cry together, you know, and most of the time you don't want that. You know, you just need to be able to vent at times about your sadness or your anger or your grief or whatever it is. And just getting it out is fine, you know, and sometimes you just sit and watch TV or, you know, do nothing. You know, women don't understand that with guys. You know, you'll go out with your guy friends, go, you know, what'd you guys talk about? Oh, mm-hmm. nothing. What do you mean nothing? You were there for 3 hours. What'd you do? Oh, we played video games and we watched some TV. And well, you know, did you know that he's going through da-da-da-da? Because his wife had told, you know, mine that they're going through that. No, I didn't know that. Well, you should call him and talk about it. No, I should let him talk to me when he's ready to talk to me. But be available for, that's one of the great things. Don't just be willing to share, be willing to listen. You know, instead of thinking what you're going to say next, just hear what the person's saying. You know, experience their reality from their point of view so you can empathize with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So what would you, just kind of as we wrap up here, what would you say, Ryan, to someone who maybe doesn't know, maybe they are going through a hard time and maybe they are grieving, but they're just, you know, either they're not in touch with what that means, they're not mm-hmm. in touch with their emotions. When is it the place of someone like a leader in the church or a person who is a friend of that person or accountable to that person to really go up to that person and say, look, you know, or to really speak into their life or say something hard to them that, you know, not necessarily in the sense of, you know, confronting them on something, but just trying to draw something out of them. Is that ever appropriate?
Yeah, it's got to be done delicately. And you really, here's the deal. And I know that, I'll be honest, the majority of people listening aren't going to hear this. They're going to listen, but they won't hear it. You have got to have earned the right to say that. If this is someone you know from afar and they're going through a tough time, and you think you're going to be the one to go and tell them to pull it up by their bootstraps and suck it up, you are wrong. You need to go and pray for that person, love that person, put your arms around that person, and just say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are that close with a person and it has gone on long enough, man, I don't know, Lisa. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, Laura and I lost a baby earlier this year, and a pastor friend of mine called, and he was trying to give me these encouraging words, and it frustrated me so much. And I go, you know what? You got to stop trying to fix me. I'm sad. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't give me an encouraging word, because it, you know, what it was is putting pressure on me to be okay, mm-hmm. to put that happy face on. I don't know why our theology, our religiosity has said, if you're a Christian, you got to have a happy face. Mm-hmm. You know, when David in the Bible says, I'm weary with my moaning, I'm drenched my bed with my tears. You know, it doesn't mean I don't know the Lord's in control. That's the time to say something. You know, where is God? God is still here. God still understands. He hears all of these things. That's my question to the Lord. You know, David did that all throughout the Psalms. Lord, where are you? Have you hidden your face from me? My enemies are laughing at me. You know, all those things. And at the end of every single one of those chapters, he says, I trust in the Lord. The Lord is sovereign. You can question the Lord. There's nothing wrong. He's bigger than my questions. He's bigger than my sadness. You know, but sometimes it's just time to be sad. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know a person well enough and you can be there for them, yeah, I mean, there are times to do that. You know, when I was talking to that pastor, he goes, Ryan, I just don't know what to say. And I said, say you're sorry. Mm-hmm. And he got choked up and he said, I am. I am so sorry. And I feel inadequate because I don't know what to say. And I said, you don't need to say anything. Just say you're sorry. And we were sad together. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, we lost another baby 2 months later. That's the worst. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything worse than that. And he called, and I remember looking at my cell phone and seeing that he was calling, and I was thinking, oh, I don't want to answer. You're going to try to make me feel good again. I don't want to feel good. I want to feel sad. Mm-hmm. I need to feel sad. It was a necessity at that moment to grieve over the loss of a baby. And, you know, he's a friend of mine and he's a pastor. And I picked up the phone. And I said, hello. And he said, Ryan, I cannot tell you how sorry I am. And I just bawled. I bawled like a baby, and he wept along with me. And I'm not kidding. That did so much more to pull me out of my funk, because he allowed me to be sad. So often we get stuck in it because no one's allowing us to be ourselves and to be sad. And so sometimes you can be Job's friends and just sit. Just sit in the sadness. Don't offer advice. Don't encourage. Just say you're sorry. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, you know, it'll time to be not sad. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I'm still sad over losing babies. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking to a counselor the other day and we brought it up and I cried because, yeah, it's been like 6-7 months. And people are like, aren't you over it yet? No, I'm not over it yet. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever will be.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Am I more over it than I was 7 months ago? Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, but it still makes me sad, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's still, I mean, it's not, I hate it how people think that, you know, you move through a period of grieving or whatever, and then they act like it's not part of your story. It'll yeah. always be part of your story.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, and for someone to say something, you know, I had a friend who lost a baby right before birth. It was a twin, and she had folks tell her, and it was her only son, and they said, well, you know, at least she can have more.
Oh, man.
Like, you know what? Like, they're a commodity? Goodness gracious.
I tell you what, yeah, you want some big advice from me? If I'm going through a real hard time, please don't tell me God's doing this for a reason. There's a mm-hmm. great possibility I'm going to punch you in the face if you say so. I had someone say that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at least you can get pregnant. At least you can have more. Mm-hmm. Really? Really? Mm-hmm. That makes it okay? That makes it better?
Right.
You know, those types of advice, wow, that's never appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mm-hmm. just imagine what it would be like for, you know, I've spoken about it and have people come up who have got a boatload of kids and they lost kids, you know, 10, 12 years ago, and they get tears in their eyes thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's sad. It's a baby. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I speak at Christ Pregnancy Centers. I just don't understand it. It's one of the saddest things in the world.
Sure.
You know, well, the greatest thing you can do is say you're sorry, you know. And yeah. if you're going to pray for him, just pray for him.
Yeah.
Really do it.
Wow. Okay. Well, the book is called Wrecked. Again, it's by Ryan Dobson and Tobin Heim. You definitely want to...
That was such a cheerful show.
Check that out. Yeah, exactly. A cheerful show.
Yeah.
But no, definitely check the book out and write to us, editor@boundless.org, and let us know what you think. I mean, I think if anyone, there are so many young adults out there who are... struggling with things. And a lot of folks here have dashed dreams. You know, maybe they're struggling with their singleness and just failed relationships and why they are where they are. And, you know, there's there are many reasons that drive into that. And there's no reason why we can't mourn disappointments in our lives. Sure. Or, you know, we've done shows on, you know, is this where you thought you would be in your career? And many people, you know, they're staring 30 in the face or they're past, they're in that decade. And they're like, I'm not where I thought I was going to be. And it's okay to, you know, to have dashed hopes and to recognize those and realize that, you know, we could say God is sovereign and we know that he is. But at the same time, we need to be the community to one another and to be willing to walk through life with one another and experiencing these things together. It makes a difference. And it, I think it it shows the face of Jesus to the world as well in how we do that. You know, it's interesting. I'll just say this. When my dad died 7 years ago now. Mm. And when he did, I had a friend here in town who wasn't a believer. She's a Buddhist atheist, kind of. She put both of them together somehow.
All right.
Anyway, she Good told times. Me, you know, here I was. I had articulated the gospel to her many times and in very winsome ways, let me tell you. And I had thrown in some wit and some humor. And she told me one day, she said, you know, Lisa, I would love to sit down with you sometime and just talk about your faith, because I really saw as you walked through your dad's death how that makes a difference to you.
Yep.
And it was so funny because my first thought was, here I was. I had shared the gospel with you in ways that I thought were so convincing, and yet it was walking through suffering that illumined the face of Christ.
I tell you what, it's the greatest gospel tool we have, is to go through a hard time and to still have a solid foundation to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
It is the greatest thing in the world. I was sitting at a luncheon one time next to a pastor friend of mine, and I overheard a conversation he was having with a guy next to him who had lost his sister. She was mentally handicapped, and she had lived a long, long life, and he had just lost her, and he was quoting a prayer. He said, you know, I've said this prayer a lot, you know, and he didn't understand the Christian faith. And he had been repeating a prayer over and over again, thinking it was going to give him solace and comfort. And he goes, and it just seems empty. And my friend goes, it is empty. I'm sorry to tell you that. And I didn't hear the rest of the conversation, but I called him a couple of days later and I go, dude, what was that like? And he goes, I'm not kidding. I've never been able to share the gospel like that. He goes, as a pastor, that just fell into my lap to say there is a relationship. Christianity is not a religion. It is only a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship is built through intimacy and through vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love one of our Boundless listeners actually has her Facebook where it says your religious views. She just has written on there, religion stood around the cross, relationship got on it. And just what that, you know, what that means as far as Christ entering in and recognizing who we were as a lost people and what he needed to do to bridge that gap. So,
hey, thanks for having me on.
Ryan,
and you're coming
so
on my show pretty
here.
Soon.
I'm hoping so.
Yeah.
We've got
it scheduled sometime soon.
I know, but I need to go on a hunting trip with you first, just to kind of keep it real and reconnect there and maybe play some Limp Bizkit.
Oh my goodness, please do not do that. I can't believe you would bring that up. It's terrible.
That is just calling out the old times.
Forever I will be. You know what? Last night I was watching TV.
Sean Varner, you better be listening because you're a part of that too. So
last night on TV, Cool as Ice was on cable.
Nice.
The Vanilla Ice movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was just awesomely bad. So, and I remember having things shaved in the side of my head and feeling a tad of shame.
Well, let's just collectively praise the Lord for Laura right here.
Yes, amen. You know, amen. Absolutely.
There is growth that happens, and hopefully, you know, God continues working on all of us. So, well, thanks again, Ryan.
Thank you.
My name's Suzanne, and I had a lousy Christmas. It was December 28th, and I felt like I needed to join a holiday recovery support group. I hoisted my suitcase into a friend's trunk, breathing a sigh of relief to be back on my own turf. With visions of the Great Christmas Blow-Up dancing in my head, and trust me, Three Sisters in Tears is not a pretty sight, I collapsed into the front seat. I soon learned I wasn't alone in my post-holiday blues. Out poured my friend's own tale of Christmas woe. And in the weeks that followed, I learned that nearly everyone I knew had experienced holiday ickiness in some form. The critical mom, the bad gifts, the boredom. We had all gone home looking forward to warm family times and returned in need of therapy. I love my family. I love Christmas. So what's the problem? Something I've noticed about this time of year is that the enemy seems particularly active. Christmas is a nasty reminder of his big humiliation, and it seems he's intent on doing whatever it takes to get people to think about anything but Christ. Think about it. Carol lyrics proclaiming Christ ring out on secular airwaves, but people are too caught up in the holiday rush to consider their meaning. The commercial push, starting earlier each year, launches us into a materialistic frenzy. And battles break out over what holiday terms are acceptable for use in public settings. But perhaps the enemy does his best work not in keeping Christmas out of public venues, but in keeping it out of families. Let's face it, all families have issues, and being thrown together for extended periods of time can be a recipe for disaster. Whether you end up playing the comparison game or confronting well-intentioned criticism, Christmas may not be the idyllic holiday it once was. That year, I arrived back in Colorado with an attitude as nasty as last year's fruitcake. Something had to change. I decided I needed to adjust my expectations and quit being so, well, selfish. I realized many of my holiday disappointments came from me wanting my needs to be met. And so, though I had been naughty, I began making a nice list. I wrote down all the things I could do for others to make their Christmas more joyful. Waking up early to share a cup of coffee with my dad, helping my mom keep dishes out of the sink, watching a favorite Christmas movie with my sisters. Each of these things were fun for me, or at least easy, but they would bring a lot of joy to others. That next year, I put my list into action. And you know what? It worked. As I looked for ways to make my family members' holidays special, I discovered a deep joy of my own. This year, as I prepare to go home once again, I want to continue the tradition of focusing on Christ and others. I'm not saying I always succeed, but I do know God calls me to love my family. He has put them in my life for a time. No matter what challenges fill this Christmas season, spending it with my family is a gift. And it's up to me to use that gift wisely.
Away in a manger, no crib for a bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head. The stars in the sky look down where he lay. The little Lord Jesus asleep on the hill.
Opening up the inbox this week, I'm in the studio with Candace.
Hi, Candace. Hi, Lisa.
She handed off the baby to Steve.
Yeah, no more little sounds right now.
Little sounds, okay. Well, we have a question that I mentioned on the front end of the show as being from someone who posted after Mott's blog post on the whole co-worker kind of building intimacy between opposite, you know, with the opposite sex in an office environment. And so let's go ahead and address this, and Candace, you and I will talk about it. She says, I have been at my place of work for nearly 2 years now. In that time, I've become good friends with a colleague of mine, who's male. When we first met, he was part of the team. This year, however, he got promoted and he ended up being my boss. The thing is, he has a girlfriend and he's not a Christian. Even though I've not gone out of my way to seduce him, during my acts of kindness and in my offering of friendship, I see there's a bond growing between us. How do I know this? Because other people see it too. I'm not the type of person to pursue a guy, neither am I a relationship breaker. But I see that clearly my actions are not doing myself or him any good. I confess that there's an attraction, connection between us, but I also know that it's nothing because he does not have a personal relationship with Jesus. How do I pull back the reins?
Okay, I think there are a couple of questions here. It's not just how do you pull back the reins. It's you said you haven't gone out of your way to seduce him, but then you immediately mention acts of friendship and kindness. And so the first thing I would suggest is that you stop doing anything that can't be objectively defined as professional behavior. The standard that you need to adhere to for your own reputation's sake, as well as for his, is to be utterly professional with him. That means you don't bring him a latte in the morning unless he asks you for one as a subordinate. You know, you don't do things that other people interpret as come-ons. I'm concerned that maybe even though you say he's not attracted to you, that you're attracted to him. And I think that may be the heart of the issue here. And you need to be honest with yourself. And if that's the case, you really do need to pull back. You need to stop spending time alone with him. If you're in a meeting where it's necessary that it's just the two of you, I would suggest leaving the door ajar so other people can see that you're acting above board. I just wouldn't allow myself, if I were in your shoes, to be in a situation where people could assume or wonder what's going on, assume that something's going on inappropriate, or wonder if maybe something's going on that's inappropriate, because that can come just from your behavior. Even if he's not reciprocating, how you react when you come out of a room that's been behind closed doors to your coworkers, you know, the vibes you send might make them wonder.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like you actually know a little too much about this guy. Like, you are kind of developing a friendship with him that's beyond professional. And I'll echo what Candace said. I mean, the whole, you know, you're saying I'm not going to seduce him, but during my acts of kindness and in my offering of friendship. Well, I'm not really sure that you should be offering friendship to him. So,
especially now that he's your boss.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it might have been okay when you were equals, you know, but now that there's this reporting structure, this really could get you in trouble. And, you know, from an HR standpoint, they would see this and kind of, you know, freak out and say, okay, we gotta deal with this.
Right. Yeah. So I think, I mean, I definitely think from your perspective, I mean, I think it is good to look at it objectively as you have and said, you know, yeah, there's no possibility between us because he's currently not a Christian. And so that's good. But you need to translate that objectivity into a little bit of distance between the two of you that, makes it definitely a more professional relationship, because there's nothing really on any kind of even, you know, co-believer level that you could share. And I'm not even sure what the appropriateness of that would be. So, I mean, really, I think you've asked yourself the question that you do need to answer. And that is, how do I pull back the reins?
Well, I think the answer is pull back the reins. I mean, yeah. I think you've asked a question, but really you've given yourself the answer. And that is, it's time to back off. Mm-hmm. And if you're having trouble doing that, again, I think what would I do if I were in your shoes? I might even suggest looking for a different position, seeing if there's another, you know, a lateral transfer you can do within the company where you're not reporting to him, because you want to, you know, tying back into the purity session, you want to flee temptation. And if this guy is posing a temptation for you, one, because he's not a believer, two, because he's your superior, and so it would be utterly inappropriate for you to date him, even if he were a Christian, and three, because he has a relationship with someone who's not you, there's a lot of good reasons there for you to create some really healthy boundaries.
Right. And I would say, too, not to disagree with Candace, but I think that it's, you know, you don't want to put too much stock in the, well, if I just move, this will change. I mean, I think, and I'm just going to be straight with you,
point.
And that is fundamentally the issue is yours. there's no guarantee that you move to a different job and you don't form some attachment with some other boss
or
whatever.
True.
So, I mean, I think you need to address it at a heart level first and see, what is it about your situation that you are trying to form these attachments, you're allowing them to happen, or you're feeling like you need to be needed in some kind of situation here, and address that first and realize, you know, the guy's not a believer. He has a girlfriend. He's your boss. That's just three kinds of, you know, not rightness right there. So
and look around and see what kind of message are you sending to the potential Christian single men who you do work with. You know, date one of them. I mean, broaden your horizons and look beyond this guy who's totally off limits, which, you know, frankly, can make a guy seem really attractive when you know that you, quote unquote, can't have him. Look around at who might be available and put your, you know, divert your gaze, make it go elsewhere to where it would be appropriate to foster a relationship.
Right. And beyond the workplace, too. I mean,
right,
you know,
church.
Involvement in your church, mm-hmm. and get to know some guys that are actually potentials out there, ones who do share your faith and who are pursuing marriage in a godly fashion, and latch onto them, and then make sure that they don't order the Victoria's Secret catalog as well. That's a good litmus test to start out with. So, well, thanks, Candace.
You're welcome.
For being a part of that question. That's great. That's it for this week's inbox and this week's show. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us, editor@boundless.org. That is just an email address, so you're going to have to find the focus address to send us Christmas cards, which we're now expecting from you during the Christmas season. So please send those to the Focus physical address, addressed to us as a team. And as I said last week or the week before, I can't remember what, make sure that you're forwarding these shows onto your friends, especially if you hear a segment that you think would be especially helpful to someone. Make sure that you're sharing the Boundless show with them, because we're trying to put out info there that will be helpful to a vast number of people. I've said before, it's been very helpful to me through many different stages now of my own singleness. And so we hope that that is the case for you. So get your Christmas cards written, get your trees up, get excited about the birth of Jesus Christ, and we will see you next week.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.